You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm counting down to the Tour de France with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, chaps.
Looking very John McEnroe there, Daniel.
I'm about to go for my run. It's very early in the morning, isn't it?
We're very early. Strange to be counting down to the Tour de France because it doesn't feel very Tour de France-like. It's the end of August. It's where I am. It's rainy and cold and grey. I imagine it's like that where you are, Lionel.
Very much so. Heavy rain this morning here in Not Watford. Looking forward to escaping to Nice.
In this week's podcast, we'll be talking about some extreme suffering, pain and discomfort. We've had our coronavirus tests. How's your nose, Lionel?
It's fine. In the UK, you have to do the test yourself. So I pushed the thing up my nose until I could sort of scratch the inside of my eyeball. And luckily, my result came back negative last night. So I'm the first confirmed member of the Cycling Podcast team on the start sheet. Still waiting for your results, Richard, and Francois Tomazo's results as well. Daniel, of course, well, you'll be in the bubble, I suppose, by the end of today, will you?
I have to have my test in Nice this afternoon, chaps. Get the results in 48 hours, hopefully.
You played a very cruel joke on me, Lionel, last night, late at night. The timing of it was particularly cruel, I thought.
Well, I couldn't resist sending you a copy of the, oh dear, you tested positive for coronavirus text message. And you
must
fell
isolate
for
14 days. Yeah. Oh, I fell for it big time.
Not really the sort of thing that, you know, I should be joking about, really, because who knows? Who knows? If you're positive, Richard, it's just Francois and I, isn't it? Travelling around.
There were a couple of considerations. Initially, Lionel, I sort of leapt around the room punching the air. 3 weeks without Lionel. And then I remembered that you were driving over in our very nice Skoda. And I began to realise the implications of your absence from the tour.
What would the team lose if the Buffalo tested positive? The playlist in the car would improve, I think. Become a bit more cheerful.
Generally, or just the playlist?
Yeah.
No, I think it did cross my mind. If anything goes wrong at this very late hour, I'm not terribly superstitious, but I have been sort of crossing fingers and touching wood and hoping that everything is all right and that we get into France and that it all goes fine. I suppose now that it's so close, what am I, 48 hours away from setting off? It goes without saying. Don't want anything to trip us over at the last minute, do we?
Well, I'll get my results today, so fingers crossed for that. But also, it feels like a lot of the stars have to align, really. I mean, there's the threat of a reciprocal quarantine from the French government, which we think might come in at the end of the week. There are the coronavirus tests, but there's the race itself, isn't it? It feels as though, as we get closer to the start in Nice, 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think we were all feeling very optimistic and quite chipper about bike racing was back and it seemed to be going okay. But, you know, there have been a lot of increased cases in Europe and in France in particular, and down in the south in particular. And there have been positive cases among riders. We'll hear from one of them in today's episode. And it all feels quite fragile and quite delicately balanced at the moment.
I think it does because of the steps we're having to take, just to, you know, our tiny little involvement in the whole thing. When you multiply that and consider how much more important it is for everybody who's actually in the Tour de France rider and team support bubble, it does feel slightly precarious, but it's going ahead. I was talking to Sean Kelly yesterday. He'll be commentating for Eurosport, of course, as he always does, and we'll hear from him in an early episode of Kilometre Zero, I think. But he made the kind of point that the tour could be raced as if it might just all come to a halt. And it just made me think that the whole thing's like a giant game of pass the parcel. And somebody will be holding the yellow jersey if the music stops. And how would, you know, what would all of that mean? What would the implications of that be for the Tour de France? I think we go into it, as you've said before, Richard, prepared for the worst, but hoping very much for the best.
There was a bit of that in Paris-Nice in March. There was a sense that it could finish at any moment, and you did feel that maybe some riders and some teams were not tailoring their tactics for that eventuality, but certainly had it in the back of their mind.
Well, you wouldn't want to be in second place, would you, if you could be in first place, just in case? I mean, it might change the dynamic of the race. It might change how everyone approaches everything.
Well, in this episode, we are going to hear from Larry Warbass, who has tested positive for coronavirus. We're going to hear from Connor Swift, who has been picked for Arkea Samsic to ride his first Grand Tour, in fact. We'll hear from Marianne Vos, the defending champion at La Course, about this year's course, La Course, of course, on Saturday. We'll also hear from Doug Ryder, the boss at NTT. But before all that, Lionel, do you have a news roundup for us, please?
I do indeed. Well, the big news broke after our episode came out last week, didn't it? And that was Team Ineos Grenadiers announcing their lineup for the Tour de France. And as we had speculated and probably come to the conclusion in advance of the announcement, Chris Froome was left out. Slightly more surprising was that no place for Geraint Thomas either. So both Froome and Thomas out. Egan Bernal, of course, in. And Richard Carapaz, who won a stage of the Tour Poland, also in. We'll talk about the ins and outs at Team Ineos Grenadiers a little bit later on in the podcast. No room in the Bahrain McLaren team for Mark Cavendish either. So that's three big British riders not taking the start in Nice. Steven Kruiswijk, who crashed in the Dauphiné for Jumbo-Visma, is confirmed out of the Tour. His shoulder is not going to recover in time. Another absentee will be the Podium Girls, which has been announced by the Tour de France organisation. There won't be the Podium Girls on the presentation podium after the stages. And that's not just a coronavirus thing. That's something that's been consigned to history. ASO has shared its rules regarding coronavirus with the teams, and any team that has two positive tests within its rider and staff bubble will be excluded from the race. We'll talk a bit more about the implications for that. COVID-19 positive cases. There have been some, as you say, Richard. Larry Warbass of AG2R, we'll hear from him later on in the podcast. Leonardo Basso of Ineos was also positive just before the Italian National Championships, and so none of their riders rode the Italian Nationals. Some more positive news, or upbeat news, not positive news. Astana's Hugo Hull tested positive before Il Lombardia and missed that race, but he has now tested negative twice and believes it was probably a false positive. No way of knowing one way or the other about that, but he is clear and he is on the start list for the Tour de France. Some transfer news. Bob Jungels is going to AG2R from De Koenig Quickstep. The Adam Yates transfer to Team Ineos has been confirmed, but Simon Yates is staying at Mitchelton Scott. And Fausto Masnada, who won a stage of the Giro last year, is leaving CCC, or has left CCC immediately, to go to De Koenig Quickstep. Quite a bit of racing as well as we head towards the start line of the Tour. The Giro dell'Emilia was won by Alexander Vlasov of Astana, who's been in really impressive form lately. Probably didn't get enough credit from me for being in that final selection at Il Lombardia last week.
Just on Vlasov, chaps, unlike us, I know to plant idle or to encourage idle speculation, but just plant an idea in your head. Vlasov and Team Ineos. Maybe not next year, but watch this space.
So basically anyone who wins a big race, and in Team Ineos, really, isn't it? The Tour de Wallonie in Belgium was a battle of the sprinters. Arnaud Démare won two stages in the overall, and the other stage was taken by Caleb Ewan and Sam Bennett. Ewan and Bennett will both be at the Tour de France, but Démare won't, of course, because Groupama FDJ are building everything around Thibaut Pinot. The Tour du Limousin stage wins there for Fernando Gaviria and Jasper Philipsen of UAE, but the overall went to Luca Wackerman, who also won stage one. Second overall was Britain's Jake Stewart, who learned this week that he'll be moving up the ranks at Groupama FDJ and joining their World Tour team next season. And another young Brit joining the World Tour is Matt Walls, who's going to Bora Hansgrohe. Quick rundown of some of the national championship results. Matthew van der Poel won with a searing attack on the cobbles to take the Dutch title. Arnaud Démare won the Groupama FDJ Cafe race.
Yeah, van der Poel rode almost on rails. Did you see the way that he rode up the kind of very thin curb up the cobbles? It was extraordinary. There's a slow motion footage of that. I mean, we have to give credit here to Daniel for the best line concerning the French national championships. He said that Arnaud Démare's lead out train would be France's largest public gathering since lockdown. That's pretty much what it looked like. Although Démare, in the end, had to win it the hard way, didn't he? Because Alaphilippe put in a blistering attack, and Démare did win, and probably was a very deserving winner in the end.
And it should be said that Total Direct Energy and AG2R also had over a dozen riders each in the
not quite as united behind one rider in the same way, though, were they?
It was quite a sight, though, wasn't it, to see at one point, I think, counted 16 or 17 of them all on the front. It did look like a training camp with some hangers-on behind them. In Italy, Giacomo Nizzolo won. In Spain, Luis Leon Sanchez won. Kasper Askren won in Denmark. And Marcel Meissen won for Van der Poel's team in Germany. The European Championships are underway in Brittany as well. The time trials have been won by Anna van der Breggen and Stefan Kung.
Nizzolo, you mentioned there, Napalm winning the Italian National Championship. The Italian National Championship that Ciro and I have been referring to for a while as La Grande Pavonata, the big peacock sort of extravaganza, organised by Filippo Pozzato. So by all accounts, Ciro was there at the weekend. He promised to send me a few shots from behind the scenes. He did. It looked pretty well organised, actually. And went down fairly well. Good course. There was a cobbled climb that was very telegenic. Looked great on TV. And good win from Nizzolo.
In the Italian National Championships organised by Pozzato, did everyone finish 8 minutes down?
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Thank you very much indeed to iWalker for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. I suppose we're heading into our first Grand Tour with iWalker's support. They backed our Giro, of course, but that didn't involve us leaving our homes. So this will be our first Grand Tour on the road with iWalker's backing, and we're very grateful to them for their support. You know, it's partly that allows us to do this, to head off to France and cover the Tour de France with daily episodes, nightly episodes, and we'll have morning episodes of Kilometre Zero as well, and more details on that series to come. One thing we'll be doing later this week as well is announcing the good causes that will be supported by the sales of Stacey Snyder's mugs and cups. And iWalk have been helping us look at some of the candidates for that, and we will, as I say, announce them later this week. The cups will go on sale on Saturday morning. The first batch of cups will go on sale on Saturday morning. If you're on our mailing list, you'll get an email with advice about exactly when and how to buy Stacey's beautiful Cycling Podcast Tour de France themed mugs and cappuccino sets. The Scuola Ciclismo Ceni, who we raised money for during our Giro, they held their first race. Well, they held a race with using some of that money at the weekend. We're waiting a report. Sadly, Ciro was otherwise engaged at the Italian National Championship, so he couldn't be there on the ground for us. But I'm sure we'll hear from the Scuola Ciclismo Ceni about how the race went, and we're very proud of our association with them.
Moving the goalposts from the Tour de France to the Vuelta a España, but I think given where I've come from through the last year, I mean, I've had an incredible recovery from the big crash I had last year, and I'm in a very fortunate position to be back racing now already, but I'm not confident that I can really fulfil the necessary job that would be needed for me at this year's Tour de France. And I think it's a lot more realistic targeting the Vuelta a España, and gives me a chance to really get stuck into something that's deliverable, really.
Enjoy the racing there. I've always loved Italy, you know, the roads and the fans and, you know, the food, obviously. A race I've always sort of enjoyed anyway. Country I love to race. So, yeah, I'm certainly looking forward to going back, and that's the plan now.
Hi, everybody. So you've probably seen Team Barry and McLaren put their Tour de France team up, and obviously I'm not on the list. Some people are going to be happy about that, some people are going to be disappointed. And there's going to be those journalists that put things for their own clicks. So I thought I'd give my own thoughts and feelings on it. Simply put, I just don't feel I'm ready this year for the Tour de France. It's the hardest parkour I've seen in my entire career. And Amarillo needs a lot of racing to get going. We just haven't had that with this year with COVID-19. But Bahrain McLaren, we do have an incredible GC contender with Mikel Landa and an incredibly strong team to support him. I know I'll be supporting the team from wherever I am.
Well, we heard there briefly from Geraint Thomas, Chris Froome and Mark Cavendish, the three big names all missing from this year's Tour de France. As you say, Lionel, Froome, not so much of a surprise. It seemed pretty clear that he was struggling to get back to full fitness after his crash last year. I think Geraint Thomas is the surprise. His omission is a surprise. You know, he was second last year, let's not forget. But a bigger surprise has just been his form. He's usually so consistent and reliable. And I spoke to a couple of people last week, one coach and somebody at Team Ineos, who suggested that he'd perhaps gone a little too deep, particularly just before the return to racing. I think when they all got together again and were able to ride together, Pavel Sivakov in particular was going very, very well and perhaps made Geraint Thomas and others a bit nervous and forced them to do too much. And it was interesting, we had Sivakov on last week's podcast and he talked about having had a proper rest before resuming racing. And it could be that Thomas was just a bit overcooked and, you know, he's being held back for the Giro. And if that's the case, and if he's, you know, done the work over the lockdown period, then with a bit of rest, he could be good at the Giro. The Tour might have just come a bit too soon for him.
One thing that lockdown really did, chaps, was put the spotlight on the team physiologists and coaches, wasn't it? Because there was an awful lot of responsibility on their shoulders to... Well, not just rely on old dogmas that have been tried and tested and sort of refined over several years. And okay, you know, schools of thought do change and a training program nowadays looks very different from one 15 years ago. But, you know, there's a sort of hive mind there that knows pretty much how to prepare a rider for a season and for an objective in July, say. But all of that really went out of the window this year. And I guess, as I say, those guys felt under a lot of pressure and were under a lot of pressure to come up with something which delivered the riders in perfect condition.
But it really changes the complexion of Team Ineos for the Tour, doesn't it? I mean, Geraint Thomas has been a fixture since they made their debut as Team Sky in 2010. The only Tour he's not been on the start line for was in 2012 when he was preparing for the Olympic Games and racing on the track at the Olympics that year. And Team Sky, Team Ineos Grenadiers without Geraint Thomas will look pretty different, won't it? Not least because you always see him because he wears the distinctive sunglasses. But it really is a kind of changing of the guard to see both Froome and Thomas not in the Tour de France team, having both been on the top step of the podium in recent years, 2018 and 2017. Like you say, Rich, the surprise wasn't perhaps Froome, and we know he's leaving the team at the end of the season, of course, but for Geraint Thomas not to make it either, and given the... Given the way he sounded in and looked in the Team Ineos video where they all talked about the team selection and the new objectives, it did look like it probably wasn't his decision. You know, he did make it sound like the Giro was a consolation prize rather than just an alternative objective. I mean, that's just reading the body language and the sound of his voice, but that's how I read it.
Well, I suspect that he's probably disappointed, but not angry, if you know what I mean, because it looked pretty clear. And I think the call de porte at the Dauphiné really was the test, wasn't it? You could see what Ineos were trying to do there. Jumbo-Visma had looked pretty good the previous day. Wout van Aert had won. And the next day, Ineos came out wanting to make a statement and wanting to ride in the way that we're accustomed to them riding. And they couldn't do it. I mean, they just couldn't do it. Kwiatkowski was very impressive that day, but Geraint Thomas and Chris Froome both bailed pretty early, and they just couldn't deliver when they were required to deliver. And so I think, in a way, I guess the selection dilemma was settled for Team Ineos, I think, on that climb, and the decision could have been made at the top of that climb. I don't believe it was made before the Dauphiné. I've seen some people suggest that that's the case. I don't believe that at all. I think that the Dauphiné was the test, and I don't think they passed it.
It's going to be really interesting to see how they ride. Dave Brailsford hinted in the interview he gave upon announcement of the of Froome and Thomas not being there. He hinted that they would ride slightly differently with Carapaz in there, and they've got Amador this year. So, you know, they're kind of looking like, if you imagine Movistar, if Eusebio Unzué's relationship with a certain agent hadn't broken down, this is probably what Movistar might have looked like in 2020.
They even look like Movistar with the navy blue, kind of the new jersey.
Yes, yes. It'll be interesting to see, and Dave Brailsford will probably hope they don't ride like Movistar have sometimes ridden in Grand Tours. But you imagine they'll be in a more defensive position in the sense that Jumbo-Visma have almost been installed as most people's favourites. And if there is a team we expect to be grinding on the front and setting a fast pace and doing the whole sort of combine harvester Ineos thing, it is them. But they themselves, of course, have had a personnel change, an enforced personnel change, because Kreiswijk has not been part of it. And it was interesting that they did, well, we talked about it last week, didn't we, what they might do, whether they would just try to replace Kreiswijk like for like with another climber, or maybe bring in another rouleur. And they've brought in Jansen, Armand Jansen, the Norwegian rouleur. So, yeah, just an interesting sort of rebalancing of the two respective teams there, which will probably have quite a big effect on the race. And I thought that just bringing Jansen in was really a sign that Sepp Kuss and George Bennett have exceeded expectations as far as their climbing is concerned at the moment, and Wout van Aert as well. So between those three riders have almost, you know, they're almost a third better than Jumbo-Visma would have expected, and that's almost created an extra rider in the mountains.
Do you think that bringing Carapaz in, I mean, he had that impressive stage win in the Tour of Poland, he's a defending Giro d'Italia champion, of course. Forget the Giro hasn't been held this year. It's all a bit discombobulating. But Carapaz coming in is a different type of rider to what we would probably see from Geraint Thomas, isn't he? And maybe suited for particularly the sort of punchier stages in the first week. You know, the tricky one on Sunday, a lot of climbing involved, but it's the sort of territory that we've seen him do well on. Maybe even the finish to Orsier-Merlet and the one to... one in the Massif Central in the middle of the first week, just gives them something different. Somebody who can maybe go on the offensive himself, you know, put people on the back foot or respond to other people rather than just riding a hard, fast pace and just chasing everything down.
Yeah, and they haven't hinted that he's there as a sort of second leader or a plan B or a co-leader. But, you know, let's not forget that Giro win sort of came about, or the genesis of that was really a counterpunch on the stage to the Colle del Nivole, when Landa had gone down the road and Carapaz sort of snuck away without anyone really noticing before the likes of Nibali and Roglic had noticed or had really started to cotton on. He'd got well over a minute's advantage.
Carapaz and Bernal are a great combination, aren't they? As you say, Lionel, Carapaz to get on the front foot and Bernal to be on the back foot. I mean, you know, we see Bernal, there have to be some questions as well about his fitness. You know, there was he pulled out the Dauphiné. I'm not sure how serious that is, but Bernal is somebody who, if he's going to win the Tour, would probably do so in the final few days. Carapaz could be the guy that wins it in the first week, as he did at the Giro effectively.
Yeah, might be holding the jersey in the game of pass the parcel. Who knows? But how significant is it, Daniel, that five of the eight riders in the Ineos lineup all have the same agent, Acquadro, the pastry chef? And does it mean that we should be calling them the Fabulous Baker Boys?
They appeared in the Tour.
So they had Sylvain Chavanel. I mean, they brought Chavanel to prominence. I mean, I've given the five nicknames. I mean, I'll leave you to work out who's who, but we've got Mr. Croissant, Mr. Brioche, Mr. Flowery Bap, Mr. Ciabatta and Mr. Cupcake. Mr. Welsh Cakes not made it. He'll be riding the Giro instead.
Well, Luke Rose there.
That's true.
Yeah. I mean, as for the other riders, you know, Jumbo-Visma, obviously. Roglic, I saw some comment on Twitter that Roglic's partner was expressing some doubt about his fitness after his crash at the Dauphiné. Have we heard anything to the effect that Roglic might be struggling, or do we expect him to be fully fit and ready when the race starts on Saturday?
Everything I've heard, Rich, suggests that he's going to be ready. Even on the day itself when he crashed, I think Jumbo-Visma were fairly relaxed about him recovering relatively quickly and easily.
And again, the matchup between Ineos and Jumbo-Visma looks quite well balanced, in the sense that, you know, they've got Roglic, who we know is in great form, and Dumoulin's the kind of the slow burner. You imagine, again, over the 3 weeks, that Dumoulin might just get better. He's coming from a low base and he's been out for a long time, but over the course of Dauphiné, he looked better and better. Who else are we looking out for at the Tour? I mean, Thibaut Pinot, obviously, he needs to take the yellow jersey at La Planche des Pelfies, as previously discussed, or maybe on the road to Paris might be safer. I'm not sure if his nerves could handle even that final day into Paris. But anyway, who else are we looking out for?
Well, do we think the winner could come from outside of those three, or someone from Jumbo-Visma, someone from Ineos, plus Thibaut Pinot? Is there anyone else that we think could win
the race? What's happened to Nairo, man, after that strong start to the year? Well, let's hear from a rider who has got to know Nairo Man a bit this year, Connor Swift, the British rider, cousin of Ben Swift, former national champion, who rides for Arkea Samsic. And, well, he did some sterling work at Paris-Nice back in the spring, really helped Quintana and the crosswinds there. They seemed to develop a good understanding between them. So I spoke to Connor Swift yesterday and asked him how he found the experience of working with Quintana at Paris-Nice.
I quite enjoyed alongside Quintana, because obviously I was like helping him in the crosswinds, but he was also helping me, like telling me, you know, when to like go and move up in the wind, etc. as well. So yeah, it was really like being with him, and he's really appreciative after the stages, etc. Both like working together and bouncing off of each other really at that race, which was great and obviously pretty surreal at the same time.
How do you communicate with him? Is it does he speak Yorkshire English, or how do you two communicate?
Well, at Paris-Nice, he could speak a tiny bit of French, but he can't speak any English. He just speaks predominantly Spanish. And then on the race radio, we have French and we had Spanish, and then they sometimes do a bit of English. But kind of when it's in the nitty-gritty bits of things, it's just, you know, I was just always near him. If he was ever in front of me, I'd be like right behind him, and he'd always know I was near him, or I'd always know he was close by. And it's just a case of, in the crucial moments, you know, just being there with him, and then you know, just him just flicking his elbow or just say go, etc., or allez, just little things like that. Obviously can't have a full-blown conversation with him, but you know, the little words that you can get, it's quite simple really.
One rider who I definitely would have thrown into the mix, Rich, besides Quintana, who you know, I would put definitely in the second tier now, was Buchmann, Emmanuel Buchmann, who I think has been criminally underrated, undervalued by almost everyone over the past couple of years. There's this sort of feeling about him that he never attacks, that he's a bit of a wheel sucker. I think that's inaccurate if you watch him in some of the bigger races. Okay, he hasn't put in spectacular attacks that have decimated fields, but he's become more and more aggressive over the last couple of years. However, had that bad crash in the Dauphiné, and you know, I was pleasantly sort of surprised, startled by the Bora Hansgrohe team announcement, and the fact that both he was in there and Max Schachmann, who broke his collarbone in the Tour of Lombardy, and also Gregor Mühlberger as well, who crashed in the Dauphiné. So all three of them. And I don't think any of them have been able to train very much in the past few days, and they're all talking about maybe not being in perfect condition or having lost a bit of form due to those crashes. But Buchmann, you know, if he can return to the form he was in at the Dauphiné, I think he's someone who could threaten Superman.
Silence.
Yeah, Miguel Angel Lopez. No, not silence, but I mean, you look at that Astana team, and once again, it looks a little bit, I suppose, Fraile and the two Izaguirres, Lutsenko. It looks solid, but not spectacular, I think. You know, Lopez looks a little bit isolated in there. But I don't think he's going to win, is he? But he's in that second/third tier. Mikel Landa's got to be in there as well, surely. I mean, he's kind of just on the shoulder of Thibaut Pinot, I think, but some terrible luck will befall him, no doubt, or he'll just be accidentally looking the wrong way when something important happens.
Wout Poels will be in the form of his life.
There'll be a split on the Turini on day two, and there'll be a 4-minute gap between Poels and Landa before they've even started. Something like that will happen.
Poor old Mikel Landa t-shirts will be flying off the shelves, though.
It's happened so often to him, hasn't it, really, that it has become almost a cliche. So it'd be quite nice to see him have an incident-free opening week, and then see. We know he also comes good, doesn't he? He's a late bloomer in Grand Tours.
Love to see Landa have a clear run at it, and you know, it is his first real opportunity. You know, every time he's been in great form in a Grand Tour, there's been somebody blocking his way, from Fabio Aru at the Giro to Chris Froome to Carapaz at the Giro last year. It would be great if Landa did have some good luck and was in the kind of form we know he can be.
The other rider, chaps, we haven't mentioned is, of course, Pog.
Oh!
Tadej Pogacar.
How could we forget Pog?
And he's the one, I think with the others we've mentioned, we pretty much know their level. We've got a decent body of evidence. We've seen what their ceiling is and what they need to go their way in order to win the tour. With Pog, I still think there's a large degree of uncertainty. We saw him win 3 stages in the Vuelta last year and was the best climber by the end of the Vuelta, really, last year at the age of 20, was he? His performances, well, since the racing has restarted after lockdown, have been a little more sort of discreet. He was good at the Dauphiné, very good. I think he finished 4th overall, but not sort of sensational, spectacular. It's all not in that company. He was up against the very best riders in the world, so we didn't see the sort of barnstorming performances we've seen at the Vuelta. But, you know, I spoke to people in his team, in the UAE team, at the Dauphiné. They said he was going as well, if not better, than at the Vuelta last year. And he also had margin for improvement. So you never know with old Pog.
What about Julian Alaphilippe? I know, you know, we can't really expect lightning to strike twice. But when you look at the course, that opening week again does look like, you know, unless he's just sitting back, he's going to be up there, isn't he? He races aggressively.
He'll be in yellow at some point.
I've got a theory, though, about Alaphilippe. I hope I'm not right in this, but I don't think he's been the same rider since the Tour last year. And I wonder whether he's still paying the price for going so deep in that Tour to try and win it. I remember at the Worlds in Harrogate, okay, it was a dreadful day, but Milan San Remo. And then at the he was all right, Milan San Remo.
Terrible.
No, yeah. The French Championship as well, though. You know, you think the Alaphilippe of last year would have held off Arnaud Démare and Brian Coquard over that finale. It's just not quite at the same level, I don't think, to be discussed.
What about the other Frenchman, Romain Bardet, who's had a pretty up and down Dauphiné, didn't he? He was off the front at some point, wasn't he? Looking reasonably good, but doesn't look like the Bardet of old. And Warren Barguil as well will be riding in tandem with Quintana, and if they get their act together, could be formidable. But both unknown quantities to a degree. And then can't not mention Rigoberto Urán, because he was in the top 10 last year, 7th, and has a younger Colombian teammate, Dani Martinez, who, of course, won the Dauphiné last week. And got to mention Alejandro Valverde, haven't we? At the age of 56, 9th last year, he'll be there or thereabouts, won't he?
Enric Mas. 40.
Movistar really need to get it together, because we talked about sort of physiologists and the role that they've played, and you know, getting everyone ready for the start of racing again. And Movistar have not hit the ground. Well, they've hit the ground crawling rather than running.
In the national championship, do you see the first Movistar rider in Spanish national championship was 16th, which is incredible, really. You know, they are Spain's only World Tour team to have their best rider 16th. And there's actually, looking down the results, the next best rider from Movistar was 47th. So it's not been a great season for Movistar at all. It is a year of transition for them, but yeah, they're not firing.
Do you know how many races Movistar have won in 2020? One. and that was a way back on the 1st of February, and it was Marc Soler at the Challenge Mallorca.
I mean, a lot of expectation around Mass, isn't there? You know, he should be sort of moving up the level and confirming that earlier promise, but it's not been a great season. The stage races he's done, I mean, 20th at the Ruta del Sol, 35th at the Vuelta a Burgos since restart, and then pretty anonymous at the Dauphiné, 20th overall, and kind of just in the group of, well, that's kind of worst team leader, isn't it, really, territory. So
name the last rider who left De Koenig Quickstep and did better at his next team. It's a trick question. There isn't one. Nobody's left De Koenig Quickstep and been better, have they?
Max Schachmann.
Okay, I'll give you that.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
Our Tour de France coverage is sponsored by the next generation Watt Bike Atom. During last year's tour, we told you about the Watt Bike Atom, and some of you out there might have heard that there's now a new generation version available. And Lionel, you've been testing it out at home. They always get the best athletes to test out these new bits of kit. Yeah. Or on this occasion, you've been trying it out, haven't you?
Oh, a dig in the first minute of our mention for the Watt Bike Atom. I have indeed, Rich. Yeah, I set it up in my indoor performance centre, also known as my office. So the new generation Watt Bike Atom has been delivered, and I've wheeled it through to the office. It tips forward onto some wheels, so you can move it around easily, because it's pretty heavy, and that's a good thing, because I don't want it slipping around on my office floor when I'm putting out the power, sprinting, or out of the saddle. No laughing, please, at that. I do generate some power. It's another sleekly designed piece of equipment. Looks very nice, and it's no bigger than the last one, just as compact, and when I finished a session, it will wheel into a corner and stay out of the way until next time. I've spent about 10 or 15 minutes tinkering around with it. I put my own pedals on, of course, and I've got the measurements of my bike written down, so it was a very quick job just to alter the height of the saddle and put the saddle back a bit and change the position of the handlebars. The first impressions are, once again, that the quality of the saddle and the handlebars really replicate a decent road bike. The handlebars in particular feel very nice, good quality, comfortable bar tape on there. And the feel and the position of the hoods are very like the Shimano Di2 that I'm used to on my road bike. So this is session one. I've updated the Watt Bike Hub app on my phone, and I'm going to try one of their warm-up programs just to get reacquainted with the Atom, because it's been a year since I've ridden a Watt Bike, but I'm sure I'll get back into the swing. I've heard that it's as easy as riding a bike. I've chosen one of the warm-up sessions in the Watt Bike Hub app, a 20-minute warm-up, so I'll see how I go.
Oh, it sounds like it was easy to set up, Lionel, even for you.
Yeah, it was very easy, Richard. You know, I haven't got a lot of patience when it comes to technology. I like it when stuff just plugs in and works. And over the course of the loan of the Watt Bike, I tried it out with a lot of the various training and racing apps, you know, Zwift, Trainer Road, RGT Cycling. It's compatible with a whole load more as well. And there's the Watt Bike Hub, of course, which is Watt Bike's own training companion. But more of that in a later episode. We'll be talking about the Watt Bike Atom over the course of the Tour de France, testing it out, talking about some of the new features, and hearing from some people who use the Watt Bike to train and improve as cyclists.
Well, the next generation Watt Bike Atom is now available to buy from £90 per month. See wattbike.com. That's wattbike.com. For details. Well, the Tour de France gets underway on Saturday, and on Saturday morning is La Course, first time the women's race has been held before the Tour de France. It's on an interesting looking course. It's neither a climber's course nor a sprinter's course. Annemiek van Vleuten is not a particular fan. It's quite short. Lizzie Dagenham quite likes it. I was keen to speak to Marina Vos, the defending champion. She won last year in Po, of course, with an amazing attack on the final lap, up the little climb before the finish. It was a really good course last year, and I wondered what she thought of this year's La Course. which I'm sure you're looking forward to as well. Happy memories from last year's race.
Yeah, definitely. As you can imagine, that was a fantastic win for me personally. And yeah, after the first time on the Champs-Élysées, this was a different course. But yeah, it gave the same sensations and the same feeling crossing the line.
Well, it did produce a really exciting race last year, that circuit. You won on it, so I'm guessing you liked it. But did you think that it was the circuit helped to produce such an exciting race?
Yeah, I think so. It was kind of an open course with different opportunities for different riders. And then you have the climbers that attack, you have the sprinters that want to try and survive, and you have the classic riders that look for the opportunities. So yeah, I think that makes for open racing and for a beautiful race.
And what do you make of this year's course? Some people have been critical of it, but it looks quite an interesting course again, and one that could produce quite an unpredictable race. What are your thoughts about it?
Yeah, that's my exact thought. Yeah, the course doesn't seem to suit any. I mean, it's not for a specific rider. It's not for the climber. It's not for the sprinter. It's, again, it suits quite a lot of riders. So it gives possibilities for a breakaway. It gives possibilities for maybe even the sprinters to survive, but also for the stronger climbers or classic riders that can make a difference. I think a lot of teams will go there with the aim to win.
And do you know those roads quite well down there? Do you know the climb?
Not really. Of course, I've looked into the circuit on paper, and I've seen it via the internet. The possibilities we have in this moment, but yeah, we'll go there and I'll see the course when I'm there.
I guess you'll be going there from Brittany. You won't have that much time to see the course, will you? Because you've got Plouay and the Europeans beforehand.
Yeah, that will be exactly the day before the race to see the course, and then in the race itself. So not a lot, but like I say, the possibilities you have these days, and of course also the team does the preparation, and you can do quite a fairly good reckon without being there.
Well, that was Marina Voss talking about La Course, which is on Saturday morning. We'll be talking about that in next month's Cycling Podcast Femina. Of course, perhaps in an episode of Kilometre Zero as well. The rumours that the much sort of discussed new stage race for women organised by ASO will in fact be a week-long stage race to come immediately after the Tour de France to launch in 2022. It was originally going to launch in 2021, but coronavirus has scuppered that. So the rumour now is that in 2022 we'll have the Tour de France, and then the women's event will begin on the Sunday in Paris and run for a week. I quite like that idea. We'll see if that comes to fruition or not, but apparently there have been developments, so we'll try and find out what we can about that. But La Course is on Saturday morning, and I imagine Marina Voss will be one of the favorites for that. The course for the Tour de France, as you mentioned earlier, Lionel and Daniel, it's lumpy from the start. It will suit aggressive attacking riders, perhaps like Richard Carapaz, Julian Alaphilippe, those kinds of riders. But what stands out for you, Daniel, we're in this weird situation of talking about the Tour as if it might not make it all the way to Paris, but assuming it does, it's a really, really brutal route, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Rich. And what stands out to me straight away, and I think did to most people when the route was announced, was the first week. So three mountain stages, really, in the first week. So stage two, which goes over La Colmiane and the Turini, and the couple of little kickers in the finale as well. And then stage four to Auxerre-Merlette, synonymous, famous for the extraordinary ride by Luis Ocaña in 1971, where he really took Eddie Merckx to the cleaners and looked to be, after that stage, in an unassailable position in that tour, but proceeded to crash out in the Pyrenees, and that gave Merckx a third of his fifth Tour de France titles. Then on stage six, Mont Aiguil, famous for its appearance in the novel The Rider by Tim Craber, which is largely set on Mont Aiguel. So they're the three, well, literal high points of the first stage, and it's going to be really interesting to see how that affects the racing. Just a minor point to that, and we've talked in the past when we've seen a lot of crashes in the sprints, and a lot of tension, a lot of riders bemoaning how nervous the finishes are in the first week. We've often said that one thing that would change that would be some kind of mountain stage or multiple mountain stages in the first week to sort of decant the general classification and mean that there were fewer riders sort of competing for the first positions in the peloton with the sprinters. So it will be interesting to see the sprint finishes in between those hilly stages and who emerges as the dominant sprinter, because we don't really have an apex predator, or we don't really have an outstanding alpha, I would argue, among sprinters at the moment.
And the sprint stages are spread out, aren't they? There's no real runs. I suppose after the first rest day, there's stages 10 and 11 are back to back, likely to be sprint stages. The one to Ile de Ré, absolutely, definitely, and probably the one to Poitiers as well, definitely, although the wind could blow in both of those stages, couldn't it, and break things up. But there's not a tremendous sprinting field, is there, really? I mean, probably discouraged a little bit by the route, and sprinters who are on teams, Arnaud Démare, the case in point, really, the French champion, not going because obviously they can't squeeze him in and look after Thibaut Pinot as well. Not even to take Démare as a backup plan says something, doesn't it?
Who do you guys see as the outstanding sprinter, or who would you say is most likely to emerge with the most stage wins?
I think Caleb Ewan, probably, but I think he'll be pushed by Sam Bennett. Sam Bennett's he's got a chance on the tougher stages as well, though, hasn't he? I mean, I think stage one's probably too hard for him, isn't it? But the one to Sisteron will require a bit of climbing, won't it? I think it would be between those two. I don't really know. I can't really, there'll be somebody, won't there, that comes out. I mean, last year we weren't expecting Mike Tournison to win the first sprint finish, were we? But no Dylan Groenewegen, and of course I think it's between those two. Can you see a third wild card getting
I mean
there?
Viviani,
of course. Viviani, what?
Yeah,
am I,
but
what am
you know, again,
saying?
Viviani,
there's a third.
Falls into that category of going on from De Koenig Quickstep and not being quite as potent a force. So I don't know. I mean, Peter Sagan.
The best sprinter post lockdown has been Arnaud Démare, and of course he's not riding.
Well, he has. Yeah, he absolutely has. Yeah. I mean, maybe Sam Bennett with Michael Morkov as his pilot fish. That could be quite a good combination, perhaps. Hard to see. I mean, Peter Sagan. Someone like, if Fernando Gaviria was riding, I would probably pick him out, actually, as maybe the best sprinter post-lockdown. But he's on the Giro program, isn't he? So hard to see, quite open. Perhaps Giacomo Nizzolo.
Well, on that, shall we just hear from Doug Ryder, the team boss at NTT Pro Cycling? He's gone for the sprinters and stage hunters team, but with Roman Kreuziger. You can never rule out Roman Kreuziger, can you? He'll be sort of there or thereabouts. And it's the Matt White quote, isn't it, from a few years ago? Yeah. You've got to watch Kreuziger.
You never know about that guy, mate. Kreuziger. You never know about that guy. Look.
And Domenico Pozzovivo, who was hit by a car in training a few months ago and has recovered to take a place in the Tour de France team. I mean, Pozzovivo and Kreuziger are kind of back of the first group, front of the second group type climbers, aren't they, really, these days? But a team that's been built to try and nick a stage or two somewhere along the way, and they've got options there. So I spoke to Doug Ryder a few days ago. I noticed, I think you were the first team to confirm your lineup for the Tour de France.
Yeah.
I think you was quickest out of the blocks. I mean, was it a deliberate decision to go first, or were you ready and you knew what your lineup would be, and so, well, why not release the names? How did it come about?
I mean, we made some big bets with the second part of the season, and I guess season 2.0 of 2020 came about. We made some big bets on what races we wanted to focus on and go all in for those. We couldn't be everything to everybody and everything to every race.
So the Tour de France was critical, and the classics are critical, and the Cobblestones classics and the Ardennes classics. We had a big focus on Milan-Sanremo, and we went fifth there, which was great with Giacomo Nizzolo. And so now the Tour de France was the next big thing, and barring crashes and incidents and keeping our people, our riders healthy and upright, which has been something kind of going crazy in cycling today, you know, and lots of injuries happening with the restart of the season. So we were ready. We had a plan, and yes, the team that we announced with Pozzo Vivo, Bösenhagen, Nizzolo, Walscheid, Gürgel, Balgren, Kreuziger, and Ryan Gibbons was the team that we felt would present us the best in the terrain that is being presented to us for this year's Tour de France. So it wasn't about we wanted to be first. We were just ready. So, you know, I think we're excited about the race. We're excited about our team, about our opportunities and what we want to achieve.
What about Domenico Pozzovivo? Because, I mean, he's another rider. You mentioned crashes, but he had a really bad crash, and has been quite a long road back for him.
Exactly. I mean, he was like the Iron Man. I mean, he had a whole lot of, you know, hundreds of grams worth of iron taken out of his body, you know, just a couple of weeks ago. And he showed great form for a couple of days in the Dauphiné, and he's got time to build up for the Tour de France, and there's a long time till the third week of the Tour de France. So, yes, I mean, he's an amazing individual. We're very fortunate to have him in our team this year. We believe that he could get back to his best after that horrific accident that nearly ended his career and almost his life as well last year. So lovely to see someone bounce back like that, and we look forward to seeing, you know, the value that he can bring and how hard he's worked and just his commitment to cycling and his passion for the sport come through, you know, in the Tour de France in a week's time.
This is the first Tour de France with Bjarne Riis directing the team. What has he brought to the team, and you know, how do you feel that things are looking as we are here, what, a couple of weeks out from the Tour de France?
Bjarne brings a huge amount of leadership. He's incredibly experienced. He's unbelievably consistent with the riders, and they have huge respect for him in terms of him, you know, Bjarne being, you know, running some of the best teams in the world. There is some conversation around he's never really run a sprint team going into the Tour, which is, you know, we're very focused on that in this year's Tour de France. So that'll be interesting to see. But his planning and his execution and his understanding and bringing people together and uniting a team under one plan, you know, through his leadership and his experience is what's made a massive difference to our team. So we look forward to the impact that he will continue to make as we go through this Tour de France and the rest of the season.
Just lastly, you mentioned there a sprint team. Have you got a sort of a hierarchy of sprinters? Is there a defined number one that everyone's working for, or is it a case of different courses for different horses?
It is a case for different, you know, different courses for different horses. We've got riders that can get over some lumpy stuff, you know, like Valgren, like Ed Valt, like Ryan Gibbons, you know, and then be there in the final, like a Michael Matthews or a Peter Sagan type of finish, you know, where it's not a pure sprint, but it's a bit more lumpy. And then we've got Nizzolo that can handle a pure sprint. You know, there's not really any stages in this year's Tour de France that are going to be easy. There's not a, you know, a 200-kilometer flat stage next to the ocean, you know, that you can look at the scenery and then sprint the last 10Ks or, you know, build up to the end. So it is a very tough Tour de France this year. You need riders that have got fight, that have got real grit to survive and be there at the finish in numbers to be able to impact the results. So that's the strategy and the focus that we've gone in with. And, you know, stages 1, 3, 5, and 7 in the first week of the Tour are stages that we think are opportunities for us. And those are the kind of things that we're going to focus on and go for. And then as the mountains start, we're hoping that Michael Gürgel, Roman Kreuziger, and Pozzo Vivo, you know, will get the opportunity to shine and rise to the top in some of the mountains, you know, stages in the second and the third week. So let's hope it's going to be a great race.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, still fueling us here at the Cycling Podcast. You can get 25% off your Science in Sport products with the code SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. It works in France, I discovered, because I used it a couple of weeks ago to restock here, and I'll be taking some of that stuff with me on the Tour, hopefully, Lionel, because we're hoping for the first time in a few years to take our bikes with us on the Tour de France this year.
We're actually riding, aren't we? Or maybe are we stepping in?
If Domenico Pozzovivo and Roman Kreuziger can get a ride, then I'm sure we can too. Great survivors. We are. No, we're going to try and, I mean, with things being different this year and the way that we cover it probably being a little bit different, we thought we'd take our bikes and use them as much as we possibly can. Hopefully we'll get a few opportunities to ride bits of the route and so on. And well, you've got some plans already in that regard, Lionel.
I have indeed, yeah. Yeah, I'll be off riding the Col d'Huez, I think, at the weekend. Looking forward to it.
Talking of going off piste, chaps, we should mention that we've teamed up with Divine Cellars again, Greg from Divine Cellars, and he has created four cases of Tour de France themed wine. There's a Grand Tour case, which I think is 24 bottles. There's a Yellow Jersey case, 12 bottles, a Mountains case or Polka Dot Jersey case, in which the wines generally come from the mountainous regions that the tour is going to go through. And there is a Green Jersey case where the wines are from flatter regions that the tour is going to visit. Predominantly organic and biodynamic wines, sustainable wines, as was the case during the Giro when we first teamed up with Divine Cellars. And we're going to be producing those lists in the next couple of days on social media, aren't we, for people to peruse and hopefully buy. Of course, please drink responsibly, everyone, but we hope you enjoy.
Why do you look at me when you say that, Daniel?
Enjoy participating in our viticultural tour of Tour de France. And chaps, you're going to be hearing, or the listeners are going to be hearing from Greg himself, as we did during the Giro. He's going to be telling people about the wines as they occur every day.
I'm going to be telling people about the wines as they occur, Daniel. We don't need Greg for that.
Extraordinary that they decided to start the Tour de France as an homage to your favourite tasting note in
Nice. That's nice. Very nice. Yeah. you're going to be bringing a case with you, Lionel.
I am. And any listeners who'd like to find out what's in each of those respective cases, we'll put full details in our pre-Tour de France newsletter. If you've not signed up, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Get all sorts of nuggets in there, details about when Stacey Snyder's mugs go on sale, for example, and stuff we've got coming up for Friends of the Podcast and our Tour de France plans in general.
We should say that in terms of our coverage, it's very much business as usual. We'll have 5 episodes of Kilometre Zero a week, Monday to Friday, 15 episodes in total. That's our morning show, which is almost like a magazine feature in audio. And we've got lots of exciting plans for that. We've got a new sponsor for Kilometre Zero to be unveiled in episode 1. And we're very excited about that. And our nightly coverage will be as usual. It'll be myself, Lionel, and Francois Thomazeau. We'll grab Daniel if and when we can from his TV duties. But we'll be travelling around with the race and bringing you nightly shows with the reaction to what's happened. And we're going to, this year, something we trialled at the Vuelta, I suppose. We had a couple of audio diarists here, Nick Schultz and James Knox. We've expanded our team of audio diarists. We've got 8 riders signed up and a DS. So the names of those riders, the names of our team, will also be revealed at the weekend as our tour coverage kicks off. But we're really looking forward to that element to it, and looking forward to the next 3 weeks, I think, aren't we, Lionel?
Certainly are, yeah. We'll be focusing on the racing, watching all the racing, and getting as close into the bubble as we can. It's going to be very different, I think, but until we get there and see exactly how it's all working, it's difficult to say. So our plans are kind of fluid, aren't they? We'll do our Tour de France, I guess, a sort of on the road version of our Tour de France, but with the racing, of course, taking centre stage every day.
Well, somebody who won't be riding the Tour de France, or indeed anything, perhaps for the next couple of weeks, is Larry Warbass, who's been, you know, checking in with us quite a lot over the last few months with his lockdown Larry journal. I spoke to Larry a couple of days ago because he has been diagnosed with coronavirus, which has had a big impact on him, obviously, and on some of his teammates as well, who've also been pulled from racing. He's convinced, as you'll hear, that it was a false positive, and as I spoke to him, he just had another test and was expecting the results quite imminently. So by the time this comes out, the situation with him might be a little bit different. But here was Larry Warbass reflecting on the shocking news, really, of his coronavirus positive test. So when exactly was this test taken?
So this was my 6th day before Plouay, so Brittany Classic, which starts tomorrow. So it was last Wednesday.
So it was a few days after Lombardia.
Yep.
How many tests had you had before then?
That was my sixth test.
You know, when it came back positive, what was your first reaction?
Well, I was pretty surprised because, you know, it's like, say like the first couple of times you do these tests, you're like, oh gosh, you know, like I hope it's negative, you know, but then like after you do it a bunch of times, you know, it's like we're taking every single precaution and we're being like super, super careful. So, you know, I just assume to open it and it's negative, you know? So like I open it and I was like, uh-oh, that's not good, you know? Yeah, then I like wrote the team doctor and I was like, small problem.
Did it come in an email then?
Yeah, it was in an email, yeah.
So I guess your immediate thought is, how did I get it?
I literally, you know, in these times, I like don't leave the house. So after Lombardia, I went to the grocery store once. I went to the beach once and wasn't even close to anyone. So aside from people on AG2R, I saw two people. I was like, well, this is practically impossible, is kind of what I thought, you know? Or obviously it's like this crazy virus and I just picked it up somewhere. I mean, I'm always wearing a mask. I'm never in public places or never close to anyone. You know, I take like the utmost caution. I was just like, I don't even know how this would be possible. And, you know, if I was being lax about it, then I would have been upset with myself because I'd be like, okay, I'm probably one of the most cautious people when it comes to this thing, you know? I was like, honestly, there was nothing more that I could have done. I mean, unless I saw zero people, but I know like I did everything I could to not get coronavirus.
We hear about asymptomatic cases and it sounds like you are one, but you must sort of do a sort of health check or an MOT of yourself trying to figure out whether you do have it and whether there are any symptoms, do you?
Yeah. I mean, the one thing it makes you do is it makes you think all day, every day, and research everything, you know? And so I do think there's a good chance it's a false positive. I got another test this morning to see because, yeah, everyone I came into contact with was negative, some of them multiple times. So I think it's very improbable that people who I spent hours and hours with in confined spaces, you know, if they're negative, I just don't see how that's possible that I would be positive. But I mean, it's obviously it's possible, but it's a very small probability. So from everything I've read, there's a small probability of false positives. There's a much higher probability of false negatives. But the one thing I think that's considering that would be, you know, a normal person who goes for a one-off test. And we aren't going for one-off tests. We're going, you know, multiple times each person. So if you think in the sport of cycling, already we've done thousands and thousands of tests for the races that we've done. So the fact that there could be, you know, probably somewhere between 5 and 10 false positives, that's not a surprise at all. One-off, it's very small chance. But when you scale that up to thousands, I think there's a really good chance that there are some false positives, and perhaps I was just one of the unlucky ones.
What does it mean for you then? I mean, assuming that the second test doesn't come back negative, what does it mean for you? You have to isolate for 2 weeks. Does it affect the Giro, for example?
If you're asymptomatic, apparently it's 10 days. So I'll be back at Torino. So it's not an issue. It's just inconvenient. But honestly, I will be more surprised if it's positive again than if it's negative. So we'll see.
Back on the indoor trainer, I guess.
Yeah.
And you might want to scotch these rumours that Matty Jorgensen's been putting up about that you might have picked it up from that naturist beach that's not too far away from where you live.
Yeah. He actually wrote me. He's like, I'm sorry, I had to do that. I was like, I mean, I thought it was pretty funny. So
that's good that you cleared that up. Anyway, well, Larry, hope you, well, don't want to say feel better because you clearly feel fine, but, you know, I hope the news tomorrow is good.
Yeah, I hope so too. But I mean, either way, the thing is, even if it's negative, it's not, you know, it's like I'm still going to miss, you know, the races that I was originally planning to do. So it doesn't really change a whole lot, but it's more just for my own peace of mind. We shall see.
So that was Larry Warbass. And we don't know, as you said earlier, Daniel or Lionel, whether false positives are false positives. I don't suppose there's any way of knowing. But if there are a certain percentage of false positives, as you'd expect there might be, you know, I'm sure it's not infallible, then over the course of the Tour de France, you know, 180 riders, each being tested a few times, it's a lot of tests, there could well be some incorrect readings. In fact, I spoke to Matt White yesterday, the Michelin Scott DS, and you know, he talked a little bit about this. There is concern about the phenomenon of false positives, and he sent me a link to an article on CBS Sports about the NFL. The NFL went through one of its biggest COVID-19 scares of training camp after there were 77 positive tests on Saturday. Upon further examination for this spike, however, it was revealed that these were false positives, all 77 of them. So clearly, false positives can occur, and the stakes at the Tour de France will be very high indeed, because a false positive will obviously, a positive will see a rider sent home. Two positives would see a team excluded. And I mentioned at the start how delicate and fragile it all seems, and these measures are in place correctly and for the right reasons. But the Tour de France is taking a big risk here, not because I think the Tour de France can in and of itself have any real significant impact on public health in terms of spreading coronavirus, but more also the integrity of the competition. You know, if riders are excluded, the competition could be devalued and undermined by that. And there could be a point at which people begin to say, well, you know, the old Tour de France headline might be ruled out, and people might question whether it was wise to try and hold the Tour de France at this particular time.
On those NFL 77 false positives, I mean, we should say that was because of an isolated incidence of contamination rather than a flaw with the test. We do know that the testing isn't 100%, and I suppose with something like coronavirus, with the wider population, is it not better to have a false positive than a false negative, you know, if you're looking at trying to control and eliminate the virus? I don't really know. That's just sort of off the top of my head theory. But in terms of the Tour de France, yeah, it would be if a team had two positives within its bubble, but they were a mechanic and a soigneur, and those two could, you know, be removed and replaced, they would still have come into contact with the riders and the staff. I mean, it's, you know, two is an arbitrary number, but what's the right number? I mean, do you say four or five, or, you know, there has to be, I guess, a line drawn somewhere. And if there are incidents within the race bubble, steps have to be taken to ensure that two doesn't become, you know, eight or across multiple teams. So they have to put some measures in place. I think you're right, Richard, about the devaluing. But again, that has a kind of line, doesn't it? I mean, one of the tests of the Tour de France and stage racing in general is a test of obviously athletic brilliance, but also physical fortitude and luck. And, you know, this is a real one-off situation, isn't it? This is something that's never occurred before, but it has an impact on sport as much as it does on the rest of our lives. And I guess it's inevitable that if somebody's in the yellow jersey and two of their team entourage test positive, then that's going to force, according to the letter of the law, that would take that team out of the race. And that would be a big story, and it would alter the complexion of the race entirely. I suppose it's down to all of us watching, not just us as journalists, but all of us watching to kind of decide where our individual line is on that, and when it goes from being kind of an unfortunate twist of fate to a kind of a farcical turn of events. And I suppose, you know, we'll all make up our minds about that as the race unfolds. But let's keep our fingers crossed and hope for the best. Just a random theory. If Thibaut Pinot's in the yellow jersey and two Groupama FDJ mechanics are positive, that's going to be a pretty unpopular rule to enforce, isn't it?
If any rider's in the yellow jersey,
of course,
it's going to be a pretty unpopular rule to enforce. And again, this is the risk that the Tour de France is taking. They've got to balance the value of holding the event, the risk of the event becoming a sort of lightning rod for mistakes that were made during this crisis. And I don't, as I said earlier, I don't believe that the Tour de France in and of itself can have a massively detrimental effect on public health or spreading the coronavirus. But it could become a symbol of the sort of hubris or the arrogance of, you know, ploughing on and acting as if, you know, you can we can do these things when actually, at best, it could be a huge PR sort of own goal. It could rebound on them quite badly.
There are a few things that have surprised and perplexed me a little bit, that in some respects ASO seem to want to push it as far as they can. For example, having at the time of recording, they're talking about having 1,700 people at the team presentation. We're all going to be sitting down. I'm not entirely sure how you acquire tickets to that or who those people will be, but that to me seems maybe slightly unnecessary. And I just hope that that's not a theme that's continued throughout the race. And I also kind of wonder in some respects why ASO would actively encourage as many people as possible within the bounds of what they're allowed to come to the race. Because, you know, as we always celebrate, cycling is free to attend at the roadside. But from ASO's point of view, they're not really bringing an awful lot of revenue apart from, you know, a bit of merchandising here and there. And of course, the host towns do want, you know, they do want people to come because it also, it boosts the local economy both on the day and it leaves a legacy as well. But I think, you know, this year of all years, sacrifices need to be made by everyone.
I mean, French football is back with crowds, admittedly, you know, socially distanced and much reduced crowds. I think up to 5,000 spectators allowed in the grounds, depending on the size of the stadium, I think. Difference with football, of course, when it comes to the teams, is that, you know, they're not mixing with all of the other teams in the leagues on quite the same basis that the riders in the peloton are. I mean, Olympique Marseille's Francois' team, of course, their first match of the season was postponed because they had 3 suspected coronavirus cases within the club. But all the other matches can go on. And I suppose cycling and the Tour de France is in a unique and much more difficult position. But the alternative is what? To not hold it at all. And I think...
No, I mean, I don't... I don't blame ASO for wanting to run the Tour de France. Of course not. I'm just, I suppose the optics of it are going to be interesting, and the, you know, the what the crowds add is spectacle, don't they? And if but the spectacle this year will be scrutinised in a way as never before, you know, and if we have crowds of people getting close to riders on climbs and not wearing masks, for example, I can see that not looking great. And so I'm just kind of nervous about that. And I think that we tread carefully. But I don't, you know, I think that ASO cannot be blamed for wanting to hold the Tour de France and wanting it to go ahead, of course. I mean, it's their business, you know, and every business in the world wants to get back to some kind of normality. But it's you know, and this the situation is changing so quickly as well in Europe. You know, a few weeks ago I don't think there were these same questions, and only in the last few weeks the questions have kind of risen up again as cases have risen. And you know, hospital admissions remain reasonably low, deaths remain reasonably low. It seems to be circulating more among younger people now, coronavirus, or the virus itself could be changing. We're reading all kinds of different conflicting reports because different scientists have different views on what might be going on with it. We just don't know. The situation in 2 more weeks could again be very different. And one of the challenges with the tour is that it lasts for 3 weeks. And over those 3 weeks, this picture may have changed quite a lot as well, which is out the hands of the Tour de France. But we keep keep an eye on it. Shall we wrap things up there, chaps? We head to Nice with hope in our hearts and a sense of optimism and gratitude that the tour is on and that we can hopefully enjoy the race over the next few weeks.
The first 2 of those things are new for me. Hope in my heart and optimism.
You're going to struggle with that, Lionel, but we'll try our best. So our first show will come to you on Saturday evening. First episode of Kilometre Zero Monday morning. Before we go, some thanks to friends of the podcast. We just released re-released Chasing Sky, which was a special made about 18 months ago about the team now known as Jumbo-Visma and their efforts to close the gap on what was then Team Sky, now Team Ineos, now Team Ineos Grenadiers. And that has been re-released. So if you sign up as a friend of the podcast now, you'll be able to listen to that with interviews with Primoz Roglic, Stephen Kruijswijk, Richard Pluger, who runs the team, and others as well. To those who have signed up, from me, a big thank you to Sarah Kotka, Justin Newman Agar, Henry Taylor, Thomas Barry, Stephen Dudson, Matthew Davis, and Neil Ashton.
And a big thank you to Keith Martin, Duncan Cross, Will Galgi, David Wilding, Sarah John, Ian Gordon, and Andrew Rose.
And from me to Thomas Patek, DJ Reese, Chris Russell, David Atkinson, Gwyn Owen, Robert Charlton, and Johan Larsonen.
And a big thank you to a very special friend of the podcast, Moyin Islam, who has very kindly sent me a copy of the Tour de France Panini sticker album in the post, because I couldn't find one in a shop anywhere around Not Watford, and I wanted to take one with us because, well, if you remember a few years ago, my attempt to complete the Giro sticker album failed dismally. I'm going to try and do better this time.
Good luck with that, Lionel. Thank you, Moyin, and thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, bonne chance. See you on the road.
Thank you. Pareillement.